Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to your favorite podcast. This is realestateinvestormba.com. We created Real Estate Investor MBA to leverage the knowledge of giants through synthesizing and providing much needed information to all investors, from the veteran investor to the new and aspiring investor. At Real Estate Investor MBA, we plan to cover pertinent information head on with our expert guests, who we will interview on what they are doing and preparing for in the days and years ahead. We aim to create MBA quality curriculum topics and themes from the information garnered among our interviewed guests in order to bring world-class value to our fellow community of listeners. We truly believe that rising water raises all ships, and by sharing this leveraged knowledge, we can create a stronger online community, which translates to stronger local, regional, and national communities. Your hosts are Jeremy Moyer, who is a veteran real estate investor and author of a new book called Are You Playing the Real Estate Game Blind? As well as Tejas Gosai, the owner of eXp Realty, the Tejas Gosai team, and also co-manager in a newly formed Regulation D private equity fund called the Lehigh Valley Private Equity Fund. Now let's get to the show. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to your favorite real estate podcast. This is Real Estate Investor MBA. We love everyone who has made our show possible, and we are now, because of a lot of work from my co-host, Jeremy, we are on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Google Podcast. We transcribe the show. There's an audio format, a video format. It's on Facebook, LinkedIn, and a lot of people have been giving us information and asking for some different topics, so please keep sending information in. We love all of you, and we're very happy. Merry Christmas in advance. But our guest today is great. Jeremy's going to give us the intro. I'll hand it over to you.
Perfect. Thank you, Tejas. So today I'm excited to announce our guest, Brian Adams. So Brian is the president and founder of Excelsior Capital, where he leads the investor relations and capital markets arm of the firm. He has 10 years of experience in real estate private equity and has advanced knowledge and some best practices for strategic real estate investing. Prior to Excelsior Capital, Brian co-founded Priam Properties, an institutional real estate private equity sponsor in 2010, where he provided leadership and direction for the firm in connection with capital markets, investment management, and investor relations. He is also a former practicing attorney, and also currently serves on several investment and advisory boards and committees within the family office and venture capital industries. So Brian, thank you so much for your time this afternoon and joining us for an interview.
Yeah, thank you all for having me.
Absolutely. So let's to kick it off, can you tell us, our listeners, a little bit more about yourself and how you ended up getting started in the real estate space?
Sure, happy to. So I'm a New Yorker who married a Nashville girl. My wife and I met up in college in Connecticut, and went to law school up in Boston and moved to Nashville roughly 15 years ago. I did practice law for a number of years. My wife's family has a single family office based here in Middle Tennessee, and they've invested in the commercial real estate space for the last 25, 35 years. So I got exposure to some of the investments we were making, some of the GPs and sponsors we were working with by being an ex officio board member with that family. And started my business 10 years ago with my business partner, who is a Long Island guy who married a Nashville girl. So the two of us started together. And I'm sure we'll get into the specifics, but over the last 10 years, we've put together a portfolio of roughly 2.5 million square feet of commercial real estate. The gross portfolio value is probably around $450 million total. And we have raised funds in the past, but our primary focus is syndicating capital on a deal-by-deal basis to a network of high net worth individuals, families, and independent RIAs.
Fantastic. You have a very good resume. One thing I do share with you is I went to law school and do not practice.
Good man.
One of the better things I've learned from law school. I thought the lawyers do their job.
Yeah.
Sticking to real estate here. But that's tremendous.
How long ago did you, can you repeat that? When did you start getting into the real estate world?
About 10 years ago now.
Okay, that's not that long ago, but it is at the same time with how much you've
grown. It seems like a long time ago on all the work that we've done. And when you're in the middle of building the company like we have, the days are long, but the years are short, I think is the best way that I've heard it put. And I think that's pretty accurate. But it's been a ton of fun. I love being an entrepreneur. I've certainly learned from a lot of mistakes I made early on in my career, but I've got a great team and a good partner. So very lucky.
Definitely.
So Brian, you mentioned commercial real estate. That can be kind of broad, a lot of different verticals and niches within that. Is there specific niches within commercial real estate space that you guys focus?
Yeah, one of the reasons I like being a fundless sponsor as opposed to being a fund manager is we have really big flexibility to go where opportunity brings us. But the majority of the portfolio is suburban office and secondary markets. So think of markets like Nashville, Tampa Bay, Raleigh, Cincinnati, Kansas City, those type of growth secondary markets. And they're usually 100 to 200,000 square foot buildings. I'm sure we'll get into kind of the future of office and what I think there. But we have done some retail. We've done some urban infill. We've looked at some triple net product. We've done some industrial and flex. But the bulk of the portfolio is suburban office.
That's great. So, looking at data metrics and how you guys analyze specific markets, like you mentioned several secondary markets. Why secondary? Why not primary? Is it just the cap rate play? It's just a little better product that you guys can make return for your investors? Or what do you look at?
Yeah. So the reason we got into it initially was for exactly that reason, as you said. We're looking for good risk-adjusted return, right? And we only work with taxable investors. So these are individuals and families for the most part. And they are looking at net of fees after tax returns. And in our opinion, in our experience, we think you need to be at least in that 6 to 10% cash-on-cash yield play if you're going to do a core plus deal to make it worth the illiquidity and the risk that you're taking on. And so when you look at that, to exactly your point, we are cap rate driven, right? So we need to go where we can find value. And without taking too much leverage or too much risk, we can solve for that 6 to 10% cash on cash yield. And so when you put all that together, secondary markets, and for the most part, office, are places that you can still get that good risk adjusted return. The way that we define a secondary market is a million plus MSA, which is kind of the gross metro area, but outside of the traditional top 10 gateway markets.
Okay. And I believe with like multifamily, for example, they're looking at demographics, they're looking at job diversity, a lot of different metrics. What are some metrics that you guys look at to pick those secondary markets other than just the total population of the MSA?
Sure. We have an investment thesis that we base all of the acquisitions on, which is that this maturing millennial generation, the Wall Street narrative has been that these folks, and I barely qualify as a millennial, barely, but I do. The narrative was that these folks are going to be living in Brooklyn in a five-story walk-up, wearing skinny jeans and eating avocado toast, never getting married, never having kids for the rest of their lives. Now, clearly that was not the case. Because of 2008 and the Great Recession, their family formation phase got pushed back on average 3 to 5 years. But as they're maturing, they are getting married, they are having children. And because of that, they're making choices about where they want to live, work, and play based on cost of living, quality of life, access to single family homes, and access to education for their children. And when you put all that together, these kind of growth secondary markets in SEC, Big 10, Big 12 country make all the sense in the world. They check all the boxes for all these people. We've started seeing that on the employee side. So affluent folks who are leaving the Upper West Side, leaving Wall Street, and moving back home. Now with COVID, we've seen that accelerate. And now you're seeing all these headlines come out of the employers wanting to stake a flag, you know, have a physical footprint in these markets so they can access that human capital. So with all of that, I think that will improve commercial real estate across the spectrum, whatever asset class you want to focus on. But suburban office in particular, I think, is really well positioned to benefit from that big demographic shift you're seeing play out.
I got to ask, I'm a big data nerd. We're hyper-focused here in the Lehigh Valley as a real estate practice, but you clearly get your information and you put it into effect. Where are your resources, or what do you rely on, or do you have like private folks that provide information, public data?
Yeah, it's all across the board. I mean, we have a team of 15 people, and we have acquisition folks and asset managers that are combing through the CBRE, Cushman, JLL data. The Department of Labor is a great place to find some of that data. And then honestly, some of the U-Haul metrics that come out are really telling in terms of where people are actually going. So we track single family home rentals, we track multifamily. We have a really wide funnel of everything that we're kind of combing through all the time. And we are reassessing that on a semi-annual basis, right? So a market like Nashville was a good place for us to be 3 years ago. Not so much now. It's becoming very expensive. I live here. They just up property taxes 32%, right? So it's becoming less attractive relative to other markets. Same goes for Austin and Raleigh. We've had to cycle out of some places and go find new opportunity, but we are definitely kind of data focused and we look at almost everything that you could think of under the sun.
Follow up, when you is it like a yearly 6 month audit, or are you just are constantly seeing, all right, this is moving in the wrong direction? Like that 32% hike, I mean, that's crazy. Yeah. And that must have been in the pipeline for a bit. You guys caught it at the right time.
Yeah. So in terms of reassessing, we have a matrix that we put together of, you know, year over year population growth, wage growth, and job growth. We track the last 5 years. And then we look at things like in place cap rate, comp set, what you can buy per square foot, where rental rates are. And one of the things that we focus on is obviously the demographic side has to make sense. The underlying economies of that market have to make sense. So we'd like to see the eds and meds story, education, healthcare, government, things that are counter-cyclical that will, you know, be resilient during a downturn. And then we spend a lot of time looking at not only what you can buy relative to replacement cost, but relative to replacement rent. So the dynamic that we like to see oftentimes is if we can buy in the best suburban submarket in a market that we like, and we can do it at, you know, Class A rents are $25 a square foot, but to build new Class A, you know, spec development, rents would need to be $35 to $40 a square foot to justify that cost. We feel really insulated as a landlord and feel very protected that we can continue to kind of drive incremental rates over time, but not have somebody steal our tenants. So those are some of the things that we track.
Brilliant.
That's tremendous. I was going to ask the question, I think you just answered it, was, if the metrics change, would you exit an investment earlier? What's your typical hold? And if that does happen, do you just communicate with your investors? It looks like the winds are changing here. We just need to exit early. Or what does that look like?
Yeah, so we're long-term hold. For us, we're trying to solve for yield for our investors. Oftentimes, we're replacing their fixed income portfolio, which has really underperformed over the last 10 years. And I think will continue to be the case moving forward. So for us, unless we're going to hit a really big IRR or a big multiple, most of our investors would prefer to continue to get that coupon as opposed to the capital back, because they may not have anywhere productive to put it to work that could still get them a 10% cash on cash yield annualized. So if the asset's performing well, we continue to provide monthly distributions and everyone's happy, you know, we're investors as well. So we'll just continue to hold. Now, if we are able to get a big number on the back end, sure, we're opportunistic. We're happy to do it. And then hopefully those investors re-up with us on the next opportunity. But, you know, to date, we have taken advantage of some of those wins that you talked about. In Nashville, we pretty much sold all of our product. Out of 2.5 million square feet, we have 20,000 in Nashville. So we would love to do more in our backyard. We just don't think it's a good risk-adjusted investment right now for the type of deals that we're doing.
And your tenants, are they more small business? Do you have big box tenants? You know, what's the typical asset look like in one of the markets that you're in?
Yeah, as you can imagine, with a portfolio of that size across 12 markets, it's pretty variable. I would say they typically do reflect the underlying economy of the market itself. So typically it's professional services, financial services, and it's a mixed bag between true corporate, credit, and local and regional. So oftentimes it can be a building with, say, a publicly traded company in it, who's the majority tenant, but then it's filled out with kind of your local regional CPA firm, wealth management firm, realtor office, et cetera. But it's highly diversified. We actually have been trending more towards higher concentration, higher quality tenants, as opposed to, you know, a building with really chopped up with a number of different tenants in it, which I can get into the reasoning there, but we feel like that's a better play right now.
Can you get into that reasoning?
Yeah. So oftentimes people don't invest in commercial real estate, or they've been burned by commercial real estate office deals, because the tenant improvement dollars and leasing commissions can eat you alive. And oftentimes sponsors and GPs don't accurately underwrite for those type of opportunities or cash flows. So what you see is year one and two, it's great. You got it at a really cheap discount on basis. It's a good cap rate. It's cash flowing. And then once those leases start to roll, sponsors have to stop the cash flow because they have to pay for TI and LCs, which can just crush your revenue. So what we like to do is see a longer weighted average lease term with maybe a higher concentration on a good quality tenant that we think is going to stay in the market longer. Because what you see is when you right size a commercial office building, it means more TI, more LC, which just eats into your cash flow. So that was a lesson learned early in our careers, where just because a building is under market in terms of rent and credit and term, you can do that work and you can asset manage it professionally, but it's going to take probably 2 to 3 years. And during that period of time, you just won't be able to achieve the same cash flows as you would normally. And unless your investor's on board with that, it's going to be a challenging conversation to have. So we started upfront loading a lot more of our cash reserves so that, you know, we've already funded some of those TILCs. And when you do the numbers and when you actually study the submarket, if it's a mature suburban submarket where, you know, 50,000 square foot blocks don't come up very often, tenants are very sticky in these places. And so you may not be able to achieve a huge bump in rent if you were to renew your major credit anchor tenant for another 5-year lease. But having that steady cash flow is what we're trying to achieve.
And could you, for the listener, could you explain what the TI and the LC is?
Yeah, tenant improvement dollars and leasing commissions. So oftentimes, if you're a office tenant, when you do a renewal, right, say you're looking at a 5-year renewal, what is often very typical in many of these markets is that a leasing broker will represent that tenant, or an agency broker will be representing you, or maybe both. So that can be anywhere from 3 to 6% of the value of that lease, which can be meaningful depending on the market. And then what is custom in our business is that you provide some kind of tenant improvement allowance to incentivize them to do that 5-year renewal. And that can be highly variable depending on the credit quality of the tenant and the lease rate that you're working with. But essentially, those two things are out-of-pocket expenses that come from you as a landlord to achieve that lease renewal. So there's something that you have to be very conscious of, because it can eat you alive if you're not underwriting it appropriately.
That makes sense. And are a lot of your leases triple net?
They're actually multi-modified gross. Ohio and Florida are triple net lease markets, which is a little bit odd. I'm not really sure why, but the majority of them are modified gross, which basically means that you pay a base year with some kind of stomp associated with it. And then, taxes, insurance, and CAM, common area maintenance of lobbies, elevators, parking lot, gets dispersed across the entire lease roll. You achieve essentially the same rent rate, but it's just chopped up differently and the reimbursements are a little bit different as opposed to a triple net deal.
Jeremy, you have anything else on that? So our listeners, you know, we started this program this year on purpose to be able to talk about navigating through all of these issues and the lovely coronavirus. So as someone who is very, data-driven, how have you guys shifted? What do you, the crystal ball fun stuff, the presidency, all this, it's just been so wishy-washy. So just from your perspective, how did you adapt? And then what do you see for next year?
Yeah, so the portfolio's held up pretty well. Obviously, office is facing some headwinds. I mean, that's no secret, right? There's this work from home mentality, and we can get into that if you want my opinion on it. But in terms of pivoting, we're not buying new suburban office right now. It's just very difficult to underwrite a probability on lease renewal or new lease. Everything's very stunted and muted right now. So we don't think it's the right time, because you could buy something probably at a discount, but how are you going to achieve a 10-year average hold period is very hard to know. And frankly, this is surprising to a lot of people and a lot of investors I talk to. I'm in the market, right? I mean, we did a deal in June. We're trying to close a deal this week. They're both for the majority office. Cap rates have actually gone down since COVID. So if it's a well-located, well-positioned, good credit quality tenant mix office building, there's so much capital out there looking for opportunity that's still very competitive. That being said, we have shifted towards looking at more industrial flex product, which clearly the market likes a lot. There's a lot of usage there with e-commerce and everything happening. And then interestingly, we did a lot of homework. We're always looking at kind of different things outside the box. We started looking at the early childhood care center space. So a franchisee model, it's called Primrose, which is a big operator in the States. It's a triple net product. So it's very similar to like a Dollar General or Walgreens, but it's early childhood education. And so that's one of the things that we're looking at right now. We have one opportunity in Fort Worth under contract as we speak. So, you know, we continue to be opportunistic and just, again, for us, it's less about the product type. It's more about the investment thesis, what makes sense and what can achieve capital preservation, good passive income yield, and take advantage of all those tax benefits that come from direct real estate ownership. And specifically within the early childhood space, there's a lot of talk about senior living, right? The aging of the baby boomers and the demographics, to your point, were data driven. The other side of that barbell are those maturing millennials that are having children. And so a lot of people aren't talking about that, but the numbers are pretty remarkable if you do the math on it.
Great, great info. How about next year? What how do you think it's going to go just regionally? And I do want you to share about the office space and what you think is going to happen.
Yeah, so we can talk about office. Pre-COVID, roughly 4% of the workforce worked remotely, which I think it's important to draw a distinction between remote work and work from home because they're two very different things. Obviously, post-COVID, that's going to increase pretty dramatically. It's going to be more than 4%. I don't know what that number is going to be. You can hear a lot of prognostication about what the number is going to be, but nobody really knows. That being said, what we saw the last 10 years of this movement towards massive densification, or what we call the WeWork effect, where a traditional office layout would roughly be 350 square feet per employee. In some of these WeWorks, they were down to 75 square feet per user. Hoteling, hot desking, you know, this massive densification of these bullpens that were being brought out. Regardless of where we are in the vaccine, nobody wants to go back to that space, right? So I think you're going to see the pendulum swing back the other way. There'll be more traditional office layouts. And because people are leaving these expensive coastal markets and they're going to these secondary cities, one of the things that is underappreciated, in my opinion, is the fact that suburban office is well positioned to handle that kind of lack of density, and you have more flexibility with the layouts, but also you can park it. You know, these markets are great places to live from a quality of life, cost of living standpoint, but they all have terrible transportation options. And so when you're looking at these places, you need to have a parking ratio that's probably 3, 4, 5 per thousand. And suburban office can handle that kind of density.
Interesting. So could you walk us through one of your deals, Brian, that you purchased recently, or one that you're going through the purchase process right now? And I'm also curious, since it's the longer term hold, like how do you protect yourself on the debt side? Do you get really long-term financing? Is it interest only and you buy, you know, caps? Like what does that look like?
Yeah, sure. So we bought a property. This is a good example. We were under contract to close the property in the first week of April. Whoops, bad timing. So that got pushed, obviously. But it's in the South Johnson County submarket of Kansas City, which is kind of the best suburban office market you want to be in. It's on the Kansas side of Kansas City, which, you know, we can get into the dynamic there. But the majority tenants are Cargill, which is, depending on the year, either Cargill or Koch Industries are the highest revenue privately held companies in America. So you're just talking about billions and billions of dollars. And then the other major tenant was Garmin, which we think of as the GPS system you used to plug into your car.
Yep.
But it actually become a very prominent white label software solution for folks that want to use GPS. So Apple and some of these other kind of wearable tech companies will use their software and white label it as their own product. So it's a great company. It's headquartered in Kansas City, and they're a very, very long time. Those two tenants represented roughly 85% of the entire rent roll. And then we had a couple of small users. We had a small realtor company and then a small kind of healthcare tech company that rounded it out. But it was 92% occupied. The weighted average lease term, which is kind of when you see the entire rent roll, average it out on a per square foot basis, how much term is on all those leases, it was north of 8 years. Great credit, great stability. We were buying it north of a 7 cap, So we were solving for something like a 9% cash on cash yield. We loved the deal and we owned the sister property. So we got an off market look at it. When we bought it, we were due to buy it in April. That got pushed. We ended up doing a bridge financing to close it in June. And then we refinanced it with a CMBS lender in August. So that deal, we were able to get 5 years interest only, 10-year term, 30-year amortization. I can't remember the rate, probably like low fours, probably 4.1, 4.2, something along those lines. And it's a non-recourse deal. So it's kind of a bad boy carve-out guarantee that I take on personally. There's no pass-through liability to the tenants. But, you know, CMBS, if you get that 68% LTV, it's, I think, the sweet spot between your interest-only period and the amortization schedule. And again, it's all trying to achieve as much cash flow as we can that we can send to the investors.
You know your stuff.
I've been doing it 10 years. I don't know.
It's kind of, I love it. No, it's really great.
I was just going to ask you, Brian, if you could walk us through maybe a scenario that didn't go as planned. You know, what did you guys do? How did you handle it?
Yeah. We've made a lot of mistakes through the years. In terms of the deals themselves, we've been very fortunate. We never lost money on a deal. Although I'm dealing with a bar restaurant tenant right now that's gone bankrupt, and it's a very challenging situation. But in terms of a deal that has not worked out the way we thought, early in my career, we did an urban infill development deal in Nashville that was a ground up. It was using the existing structure as a grandfather clause to enable us to build more square footage than we otherwise would have been able to. And we needed the blessing of the local Metro Council person to do all this. Well, we all completely underappreciated the local political machinations that were involved there. And we got caught up in an election. Long story short, we lost a tenant, had issue with codes. It was a real nightmare. I had a full-blown personal guarantee on the deal. We ended up being able to work with the bank to buy some more time, and we got out even on the deal. So nobody made money, but nobody lost any money. But it was 12 months of really, really hard work. And that's why I don't do development deals anymore.
As somebody who built a bunch of hotels in my 20s, no way.
Yeah. And I think that's important, right? I mean, I think when you're young, you don't appreciate the risk that goes into those. And you look at the return profile and you say, man, this would be great. And some of it is just style, right? I mean, I don't have the appetite for that type of risk. And the self-realization of that has made me understand that, you know, even though I might be able to achieve higher IRRs and multiples, it's not a sustainable business for me, and I don't feel comfortable in that business. And I realized that recourse and guarantees, obviously they impact my own personal balance sheet, but they also really impact how a GP behaves and responds when things are in distress. And I think it's an important question that LPs and investors need to ask more of is, hey, what is the nature of your debt? What is the recourse liability? What is the carve-out guarantee liability? Because when things go sideways and the chips are down, even if you are a fiduciary, you're going to act in your best interest, let's be honest. And so I think that's a risk that investors need to appreciate when they're looking at a deal.
Definitely. True words.
That's great. I like that a lot. Actually, kind of leads me into my next question. So in your bio, you referenced being a board member of some family offices. Have you ever partnered with family offices or RIAs, you know, and if so, can you just give us an example, maybe some advice to our listeners if that's something they're looking to do in the future?
Yeah. So I would say the 80-20 rule applies for my business like it does for most businesses. And oftentimes that 20% in terms of the investors represent 80% of my total equity in the deal. And more often than not, that means that it's a family office or an independent RIA multifamily office. And so we definitely have partnered with a lot of those type of groups. And what I would tell people, because often I hear this a lot now, family offices have become kind of a term thrown around that I don't think people really fully understand or appreciate. And these partnerships that represent this lineal descendants of a certain family, they're not going to be the turnkey solution for you. They are in the capital allocation business, but they get pitched a lot. And I think the biggest thing you need to understand is the families are just like your family. They're crazy, like everybody else. They're unpredictable. They can be schizophrenic, and they're dealing with a lot of issues that you and I are dealing with our own families. They're no different. They just have a lot more zeros behind their name. And so I think what the important takeaway is, a family office is not represented by the amount of AUM that they have or how many zeros are behind the number. It's a mindset and it's a mentality. It's a multi-generational time horizon, corpus of assets that are meant to maintain a quality of life over that multi-generational time horizon and avoid paying taxes. So when you go and approach one of them, if they're a legitimate family office, you have to come with them with that empathetic mindset of, hey, I can solve this problem for you. Because the problem that they have is, if you think about, you know, three generations, which is typically the time horizon that one managing member of the family is dealing with, you've got 3% inflation, a 4% spend rate, and the exponential growth of the family. And so when you do all that, the return profile of their assets have to be somewhere in that 10 to 12% average range. It's a very difficult thing to achieve. So they are looking for solutions to solve that problem. But you have to understand that that's the mindset that they're approaching it with. It's not just, hey, I can write big checks and this is going to be a turnkey solution for me as a sponsor. It's more about, you know, to be cliche, building that relationship and coming to them with a solution to their problem instead of just hard pitching them day one.
Tremendous. I know we take some quotes from our program and put them out there. That's got to be one.
Yeah, happy to do it.
Jeremy, we're running on time. You got one more?
Yeah, I have one more, and then we can Brian can let our listeners know how to reach out to him if they have questions or just want to follow up. But, you know, Brian, you, as you mentioned at the beginning of the program, you know, you are busy. You have done a lot over the last 10 years. You know, to be able to do that and be at the top of your game, I'm sure you have daily habits that you've instilled, you've found out over the years. You know, can you just kind of name a couple of them?
And do you have kids?
I do. I've got 2 kids, 7 and 4. My 7-year-old's actually right here hanging out with me today because he had a half day as the school's winding down for the holidays. But yeah, 2 boys, a wife who works. And it's interesting, your question, because I've been reflecting on that a lot. Pre-COVID, I was taking 100 to 150 flights a year, 25 to 30 nights on the road a year. And because of COVID, I haven't been traveling as much, which enabled me to do more things like this. What's been interesting is I used to get up at 4:10, coffee, a little bit of meditation, and then I'd go to the gym for a 5 o'clock kind of session. Now I've been embracing my sleep like it's crazy. You know, I don't wake up till 6:30 now, and it's incredible how much more energized and productive and efficient I think I can be with my day. And so I think your question is a really good one. I think an even better one is being able to learn from your daily habits and not be held prisoner by them and feel like this solution has to be the right one for me. Because for a long time, I thought I need to crank out 12, 15 hours of work a day in order to be productive. I just don't think that's the case for me personally right now about how I can kind of be the best manager I can be. So getting my sleep, making sure I get exercise. And then a big thing for me is being outside, especially being kind of cooped up with COVID. I'm very lucky. We've got a decently sized piece of property and I've got dogs. And so I often will take phone calls just walking around the property, and it really changes my mindset pretty dramatically. So
I got to thank you for that answer, because we ask everybody, and it's good to hear. I always ask about kids because I have 2 kids. Jeremy has 2 kids. I think we all have boys, actually.
Oh, nice.
And it's just, it's difficult to navigate and keep your head on straight and keep pushing and pushing and pushing. But really tremendous, Brian. You're a, you know, great, great. I hope to have you on the show again. Maybe
anytime. Yeah.
Can you just give contact info if anybody's interested in reaching out to you?
Yeah, sure. Happy to. So I'm very active on LinkedIn. You can look me up, Brian C. Adams, Excelsior Capital. Drop me a note, send me a message. I'm happy to talk to you. You'll probably get your money's worth out of my free advice, but whatever I can do to help, I'm happy to do it. And then if you want to learn more about what we're doing, you can go to the website, excelsiorgp.com. You can sign up for our newsletter. Interested in investing, you can learn more about the opportunities there as well.
Tremendous. Well, thank you, everyone. This is Brian Adams with Excelsior Capital. I'm Jeremy Moyer. This is Tejas Kasai with Real Estate Investor MBA. Thank you very much, and we look forward to seeing you next time.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Excelsior.
Ever upward.
That's right.